This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me open the final session. You will have noticed that afternoon tea, custard tarts were served. And there's a reason for this. Yes? There is. The custard lobby is in the house. The reason for this is that, as you know, Mike was born in Blackpool, which is in Lancashire, and grew up apparently on a diet comprised exclusively of custard tarts. And custard tarts figure in the diet of the Centre for Historical Research and the Research Centre's morning teas from time to time. So in a further, very quiet tribute to Mike, we served custard tarts for afternoon tea. And I hope they've got some left over for this evening. Now that I've got your attention with custard tarts, can I say that we were overwhelmed with the number of people who wanted to contribute to today's session. As you can see, we've packed a few in the substantive sessions, but we also thought we would love to have give people an opportunity to contribute in an informal way. And so the final session of today's conference is called Open Mic, in which those who aren't on the formal programme can have their say. Now, through a process of essentially asking Mike who he'd like to have say something, I've got half a dozen people whose names are here, and I'd like to invite them to make brief contributions. But I'm hoping that'll only take us 20 minutes or so, and that thereafter, we're very happy to open it up to other people as well. Mike's here and can respond and, you know, can have a microphone anytime he likes. So could I first of all, without further ado, call upon Professor Calahiro Santoro, who's come all the way from Chile. We've had people come from all the way across Australia. But Calahiro, okay.
I actually have a formal presentation, but I handed to Joe Bertini to do the editing, just to be sure that everything was in good shape. So saying that, first I would like to say that I'm happy to be here, and also to realize that this is a good way to celebrate people and to give honor to people, not when they are already not here, but when they are so old that they are not realizing what is going on, you know, with all this celebration, you know. So which is a custom that we have in our country, you know, people die and then we have a huge celebration in the cemetery and so on. Oh, he's sitting over there and a lot of his scores and pictures, but he doesn't know what is going on, or she doesn't know what is going on. So in saying that, I would like to say that when I first met Mike was in 2002, and when listening people today in the morning, I have been understanding some of his way to approach things. You know, he show up in our museum, you know, in the little valley in the Azapa Valley, with a thick volume, you know, with his project of the exhibition of the Southern Hemisphere Desert, you know, and he knows precisely what he wants for our collection. This was his first time in our museum, but he perfectly knows that he wants this shellfish hook, you know, and not the other one that we wanted to give it to him. So. But, you know, and the other thing that impressed us was he was very formal and sort of rigorous in it, but in a way, in a sense that he was very respectful also not only of the archaeology, but also of the local population. And I think when he presented this Atacameño in the film, it's a good example that he is always concerned, not always with the well-educated people, but also by the local people. And so we did a lot of field work. And so by walking over what we call our driest place on the earth, you know, the Atacama Desert, they say, why can you talk about a desert when you have all these green valleys with olive trees and tomatoes and everything growing, you know, nicely? Well, so by discussing this with Mike along the way, you know, during the 2 or 3 days that he was there, so I realized that the desert not only changed through time, but even in our own time today, the ideas or the vision that we have about desert are totally different. What we see about our desert is totally different. What I saw about your desert when I went in 2007 to Alice Spring. So I think that talking with Mike, he said, well, you know, you haven't been doing anything, but you haven't done any archaeology on the actual desert. And he was right. Most of our archaeology have been along the valleys or along the coast. So since his comment, I started to do real this is archaeology. So, and well, the other thing that happened to be there, he has this exhibition, but then he has the idea to have this Southern Descent Conference. The first one was taking place here, and now we are having next year the fourth conference in Argentina, meaning that he created this network that it is impressive how he managed, without putting much, you know, effort, you know, to create that, but the network that is now functioning because of the Southern Conference, Southern Descent Conference, it is impressive. And we have learned that the only way that you can understand the natural history and the cultural history of the desert, you have to have many different eyes and experience, photographer, poets, and everything. So that's my talk. Thank you, Joe Bellini, for your editing. Bye.
Thank you, Calahiro. So there you have it. Mike has not only transformed the history of Australia's deserts, but also of South America's. Now, where's Alan Williams? There he is. Oh, you would be right in the back corner. Alex will give you a microphone. You got the floor for a few minutes, Alan. Thanks, Alan.
No worries. This was sprung on me this morning, so I don't have any pictures or anything. But just coming as from a student, I think Mike and many others in the room have, in the last 30 years or so, have just increased an amazing knowledge of the desert. The architecture of the desert, I think somebody called in the prehistory, is just wonderful now compared to what it was 30 years ago. And, you know, for me personally, Mike, I think it's been made quite clear, Phil Jones said it very well in that, you know, whatever Mike says, it's worth listening to. It is always good, whether it's on morphology of grindstones or Rhys Jones nearly landing on him in Malacanang while he's digging the site. Some wonderful stories humanising the archaeology, and always has time to educate and explain things. I've often sent a one-line email on a question, and you know, 3 hours later there's a whole thesis sent back to me. So it's not uncommon. So yeah, for me, it's been a wonderful, it still is a wonderful experience to work with Mike and be a student of Mike, and hopefully the PhD will get finished this year one way or another, if he ever lets me. I guess, you know, as a young researcher looking for the next 10 or 15 years of a career, I'd be keen to see, you know, where do you think research needs to go? We know an immense amount about the deserts now. What is left? Name me a site you haven't been to or dug. Will be a good start, and I'll put it to you, Mike. What do you think the next 10 years should look like?
Oh, there's quite a few avenues. I mean, the desert's still open slather for research. I think at a general level, we're still to crack the whole problem of dating rock art. And the moment you date rock art and can integrate that properly with the rest of archaeology, all of a sudden you've got another dimension opens up about these social and cultural landscapes. We're not doing too badly at the moment, but without dates, a lot of it's conjectural. That's one thing. Another area is about as research has become more industrialised and more competitive and big grants and churning through the money and chasing the money rather than the ideas, we've sort of forgotten that the building blocks of our discipline are really well-machined site reports. And it's no criticism of anyone, but, I mean, for instance, we don't have any good published survey plans of the Inamica quarry complexes or studies of their production or their history or the order in which those quarry pits were opened up. You know, you name it, that whether you're looking at a Silkrete knife quarry, the Mount Isa axe quarries, the big red ochre quarries, we often lack basic good site reports. That goes for excavations too. And, you know, in my dream, I would have a shelf full of really good, thorough site reports, and they would become the basis of the sort of prehistories we write. The third level is our general approach. We've become quite abstract, quite problem-oriented, quite theoretical, and all that's good. But along the way, we've forgotten, I think, a basic historical framework. And if you look at prehistory, if you look at the archaeological record as a form of history, It opens up a whole range of new questions. For instance, if you look at the desert between 45,000 years ago and 35,000 years ago, that's that really that first interesting phase of the establishment and consolidation of desert settlements. We know very little about that. You know, we've got a few dates, we've got a few interesting finds, but we don't have a feel for that in detail. But whatever that world was, it was shredded by the last glacial maximum, and so forth. You know, there's a whole range of questions we can ask. I hope my book will, in a way, it's a small book. Yeah, it's a big thick book, but it's a small book in terms of it's a work of sort of history. But I hope it will trigger a lot more comparative work, where we compare our deserts with those in South America and Southern Africa, a lot more historical work and so forth.
Thanks, Mike. I worked with Mike on an excavation at Lake Woods in the 1980s, and again, that was another fluffy clay that needed to be dug through with jackhammers. And on a large scale, so it was a labour of some, well, a lot of time to reflect and a lot of stories told and a lot of dampers cooked and all those formative things, was the stories around the campfire as you try and work out what's going on in a complex landscape. So all of that is part of the influence that Mike's continue to have, spreading his vision, always pushing ahead of where you are, connecting things together, and synthesising, but also bringing in all these lovely leavening literary knowledge and reflections from all sorts of sources. So, yeah, being influenced a huge number of people and very generously gave me a whole edition of the Horn Expedition notes, which I have used extensively, a great and very treasured sort of hand-me-down when he got the proper facsimile version. Mm. So thanks, Mike, for, you know, doing what you do all over the place in large and small ways.
Good to know. Now, I've got a list of names, but I'm also conscious there are people who haven't been fingered. Is there anyone who'd like to say something?
The Camel people call me Wilco, and I've been a stockman all my working days for the last 22 years, spending quite a lot of time with camels. And naturally, I've looked at country from the point of view of a stockman, how much feed there is to feed the animals. And I now owe a great debt to Mike, because I look at deserts in a different way now, Mike, not just on the herbage on top, but looking for all of the little things that you taught me to look for. I have spent a lot of time with Aborigines too, and I learned a lot from them, but they weren't very explicit about all those things that interest Mike and now interest me. So thank you, Mike.
You know, I think what today has shown as much as anything is that, you know, if you love your craft, it's worth talking about it, I'll talk about it to anyone who stands still, really. I'm not advocating talking about yourself, but talk about the work and the land. And I think this can only be good if it brings new understandings of the landscape, a public understanding of archaeology and its potential, I think, has ramifications right through public debate. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, sometimes we say, you know, is archaeology worth doing? You know, it's very little practical value. But if, can you imagine Australia today if we hadn't had 30 years of archaeology? What would our public debates about Aboriginal land rights be? You know, if we saw people as just, you know, very recent arrivals by canoe from the Indo-Malaysian archipelago, what weight would we give to the dreaming? What weight would we give to the first people? I mean, it would fundamentally change our debates about those sorts of things. Now, I'm not a political crusader. I just want to get on with my archaeology. It's a love of the chase and discovery. But it is an important line of work. And it's important to talk about it and share your interest. And it's a two-way thing, of course. Wilco's learnt a bit from me about archaeology, but I've learnt a huge amount about camels and country, and camels are a really fantastic discovery on my part.
I've observed, Mike, from a distance until a few years ago when, with Peter Vith, we collaborated in the excavation of the core at the Mullen, in the Mullen Lakes. So Mike, in opening up the story that in a sense began earlier, and I was privileged to be associated with or start off the Mungo exercise, but to know that that has spun off into something bigger, something opening up the central dry land of Australia, Mungo was just the beginning. And in that context, we could not have done better than to have the footsteps of Mike Smith taking up where Mungo has not left off. Mungo is still going and has many agendas still to address. But to find that Mike has taken that to advantage, seen that as a great opportunity, something that needs to be done, and has wakened Australians generally. I think there's a sense here that it's time when we think of the nationality of who we are. We seek an Anzac Day and Australia Day. We continue to revisit our search for our national identity. Our national identity is beneath our feet, and Mike has helped establish that in his work.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you want to respond?
I should respond. Thanks, Jim. Of course, there was a cohort of students that were following you to Lake Mungo, and I think one of the great opportunities I had was to be able to rub shoulders with people in the old Department of Biogeography and Geomorphology. Gurdip Singh with his pollen work, to follow your work at Lake Mungo, to work with John McGee, and to learn something of the craft of the quaternarist. And in a way, I found myself a bit of a bridge between the quaternarist and the archaeologist. I sit on the National Committee for Quaternary Research. But I think, those skills that the quaternarists bring to reading landscapes have been very important for archaeology. When we don't work in partnership as much as we should or as much as we used to in the 70s.
Thank you.
I was privileged to go to two of the early Porritjarra excavations and work with Mike on those. And I came away with being really inspired, not only by the archaeology in the country, but by Mike's passion and by the way he shared everything, information, everything about the learning, whatever. It was just a very sharing experience, and I'd been on many other excavations before then, and this stood out as absolutely unique. And he's continuing to share, even though I hadn't been on excavations with him since then, every now and then in the mail or through some other method, more as he'd produced other information or as something else had come to light, he'd sent it on, and it was always greatly appreciated. And I just wanted the chance to say that. Now, the other part that I wanted to say was that it's come up a few times today, and it might sound frivolous, but it isn't when you're on a dig, is the food. I was very impressed with Mike's care for his workers.
And although we worked hard, you know, it could be a long day, you know, 7:30 till 6, something like that. I was surprised after previous experiences on how well he'd planned menus and how to get the most out of the time to prepare meals and to what he could provide for those. It was the first time I'd come across vacuum-packed meat like that, because this is no refrigeration. Mm. He'd put on a roast in the camp oven early in the morning, and it would be ready when we'd come back at the end of the day. How I learned all sorts of tricks about preserving food without refrigeration, wrapping cheese in chucks and in plastic bags, and taking brie when that would no longer suffice because you're into your third or fourth week. And that comes in a tin you can just open, and all that sort of thing. So it was the quality of it that always surprised me. And along with those wonderful discussions around the campfire, there would always be a small luxury. There was nothing extensive or over the top, but it was always that bit that showed you. It was all that always that little bit extra, so you could finish off the evening in a really nice way, whether it was a tot from a bottle passed around or something that just pulled out of a pocket. And I personally have also taught my kids how to cook the pan dampers that he used to do for breakfast every day. They were so delicious. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, a pan damper in a way is starvation food, but it tastes really good towards the end of a dig. I mean, there are lots of tricks, you know, to living out bush. You don't want food that you have to handle a lot as you prepare it to cook, because you're dirty. You can never stay clean. I've always been very proud of the dedication and discipline of my field teams. You have to lead by example a little bit. It doesn't happen automatically. Norman Tyndall at the South Australian Museum was reputed to have made a cup of tea for his crew in bed every morning. I didn't quite stretch to that, but we did all right.
Good-o. Thanks. It occurs to me I'm a humble historian, and historians tend to work on their own. And I think one of the differences between the disciplines is that you guys do things together, and you don't just work together, but you live together for long periods in isolated places. And I can see the camaraderie that generates coming through. So there are insights even for historians here. Now, can I ask, is Isabel McBride in the house?
Okay. I think it's been a great, great pleasure and indeed an honour to be here today, and I'd just like to express that and express my admiration for the work that Mike has done over the years to promote an archaeological concern for the very special questions that need to be asked if you're looking at desert environments and at the sort of social life that will be developed by societies in desert environments. And I think that has been a great contribution from you to move beyond the analysis of assemblages and putting them all in order in time and space, but to move to considering the people behind the artefacts. And I think that has been a great contribution to the life of all Australians. And the other great contribution, which I'd like to mention, which has come out from a lot of discussions today, is the way in which you have thought of comparing Australian desert life with the way in which societies develop life in desert in other parts of the world. And well, we've already had contributions from people who've been involved in that, and that again has been a very exciting contribution, which we're all very grateful to you, because it makes us think of the environments and the economic and social opportunities and difficulties that face societies in desert environments, and also to put them in the context of changes over long periods of time. You just raised that in the answer to comments on one of the questions that came up earlier. So I'd just like to say we all very much indebted to you for raising those questions and giving us new perspectives on the lives of societies in desert environments, not only in Australia but in other parts of 23 degrees south. So thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks. My name is Mark Friedel from Alice Springs, Dick Kimber's wife. Mike, you might not remember, but I do recall 1980 very clearly when I was 6 months pregnant with Steve, and there was this knock on the door, and outside was Mike. And here he was, very cheerful, blue-eyed man, slight turn in one eye, and one of the only things I remember you saying, Mike, was, "How's your pregnancy?" I remember thinking, what? Who is this man? But it was the start of a terrific friendship. Our son Steve was just a little younger than Ben, who's in the photo there. And I must say you were a bit cleaner then too. But Moshu and the family all became very good friends of ours. But my other thought is that given the work that I've done been involved in Arizona ecology, it's enriched things greatly for me, because having first of all come in as a fairly detailed ecologist in the arid lands, to then have the benefit of people who worked with satellite imagery, so you get that breadth in space, but then also to keep learning from the sorts of things that you were doing about the breadth in time as well. And it's been, I think it was culminated in being one of the many people who had the privilege of being able to read your manuscript of your book before it actually gets printed. So it's been a terrific privilege and a real pleasure the whole time. So thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mark. As I've become better socialised, I've tried to school myself to ask about people's day and say, ask how they are before I start talking to them about archaeology.
Hi, my name's Sue Kastrick. I'm representing the friends of Mike from those days in 1975-76 when we shared a house. And I just want to kind of correct, I guess, a view of the idea of the prehistorian on this inevitable track, because what I was struck by, I guess, when we shared a house was what a strange breed these prehistorians were, and in particular the one up the back of our house. He's wearing a suit today, but in those days Mike's idea of dressing up was to change from his khaki shorts into his khaki long pants. We also had that when we were invited to come around to have a drink, we drank out of Vegemite jars. And one time, Mike Romanek remembers that, one time we were asked to look after the dog when they went away, because they were always going off onto these, you know, these jaunts into the bush somewhere. We had to feed the dog. I opened up the fridge and it was full of skulls and strange things in jars. So not only, you know, I just wanted to say that in order to be a prehistorian, he also had to survive the whisperings and strange stares from the people in the front of the house.
Thank you. See, it all comes out now, Mike.
Just a word of explanation. You had to build your own reference collections in those days. So if you wanted to identify animals, you had to have, from skeletal remains, you had to have an interest in roadkill.
It's just wonderful to hear all this great stuff about Mike. And all I want to say was, that is all true, but the reason it's been, you know, amazing to have him go away a lot in those days when there was no communication of any sort, no mobile phones or even the radio phones, as you heard, didn't work and so on. But so there have been some interesting times, but all I want to say is the one great thing about Mike is that he's a very decent bloke. So that's, apart from everything else you've said, it's all true, but that's something that I think I just wanted to say.
Hear, hear. And you get your chance to reply now, Mike, because I think Marnik's comment is the perfect opportunity to turn from open mic to, as the program says, a word from Mike. So, Mike, if you'd like to take the podium, we'd be very keen to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Well, you know, obviously I'm tremendously thrilled with this tribute today. Thank you. I think it's a very interesting new way, I think, to do a fish drift. I'm thrilled I've got so many friends. And I'd certainly like to thank all of you for coming along today, my friends, my family, all our speakers, my colleagues. And, of course, I'd like to thank the National Museum of Australia for its generosity in honouring me in this way. When I was first approached with the idea of a fish drift, you know, that scholarly tradition of offering a book of essays to honour a colleague, I admit I wasn't enthusiastic. Some have worked quite nicely, but these sorts of publications are too often dull and dusty works, full of the leavings of one's bottom drawer, that manuscript that was unpublished or elsewhere, that has only the most tenuous connection with the person you're honouring. And it's really about you rather than them. So I suggested something more lively, something perhaps that looked at the intersection of desert archaeology with arts, poetry and film, something with the movement and colour that we've come to expect from the National Museum. You know, one of the special things about working at the National Museum is its skill and experience in putting together a bit of theatre. You only need a whiff of a good idea and those marvellous folk in public programmes swing into action. And I really do owe a debt of gratitude to Heidi Pritchard, Alex Kidd and their team, and to Peter Stanley, Anne Farris and Cameron Muir for putting together such an engaging programme of work today. I've always felt that any mature discipline needs a literature, yeah, in a very broad sense, especially a discipline as important and as interesting as archaeology. Needs to leave some traces in public life other than just in the research record. There's a sort of personal interest here. The painting, Andy Martin's paintings about Puritjarrah, may well be discovered by art historians long after my own work at Puritjarrah has been forgotten. So, in a sense, I'll leave a fossil trace to be discovered. Over the years, I've been keen to embed archaeology in fine art, poetry and literary works. And so today, I especially thank our poet and our artists and our filmmakers for applying their skill and their craft to the task and reflecting the beauty of Australia's deserts. I've long wanted a poem that captured the essence of Australian archaeology. And now, thanks to Mark, we have one. And so my next ambition now is for someone to write a novel that really captures, you know, the whole thrill and practice and the grit and reality of archaeological work. I'd like to take a few moments to say something about the Milieu. At one stage, I'd fondly imagined the day might be more about the Milieu than the man. It's been a very interesting period in Australian archaeology, but inevitably it's a tribute. It's about the man. So just to sketch out how I see the last few decades. Firstly, I feel I've been privileged to be a member of a quite a talented generation of Australian-trained archaeologists, a generation that in some respects occupies a key transition point in the discipline. On the one hand, it was the last generation to be involved in the primary exploration of a continent's prehistory, what Max Mallowan once called the Elizabethan phase of archaeology. He used it in a different context, but it's a very nice phrase. And we're also amongst the last to work with Aboriginal people who grew up in the bush without contact with whites. I'm not saying, you know, necessarily all this applies to me, but as a generation, it's a very interesting generation. On the other hand, it was also the first to have access to such a dazzling array of archaeometric forensic science and dating techniques, and such ready access to digital media, databases and analytical software. We've been really privileged in this. It's hard to imagine now being able to work without the internet, without PDFs, without sat phones. We've got very used now to the great battery of scientific techniques we can bring to the samples we bring back from the field. We really can see a world in a grain of sand. It's a pity, though, if that overwhelms the art and craft of the actual fieldwork, though. We must not ignore the world when we collect our grain of sand. Otherwise, as Max Mallowan said again, we tend to miss nothing, but we find nothing either. It was my cohort that picked up the baton from John Mulvaney and Rhys Jones and Jim Bowler. In a sense, I represent this next wave of Australian archaeologists, and I was one of the first students in that undergraduate department that John set up, arriving in 74. The department was going in 72. It looked like it had existed forever, but really, you know, just in its second or third year. And going back a little early, I was very fortunate that my schoolboy and undergraduate years corresponded with a surge of archaeological excavation in Australia. So I was able to work at all these fascinating sites at Runca Burial Ground, Cathedral Cave and so forth. I consciously began my apprenticeship. I always regarded archaeology as something that needed a field apprenticeship. I began it early because, you know, I felt I was a bit of a klutz. I didn't come from a well-heeled or terribly literate background, and I felt it would take me a few extra years to get up to speed. So I felt that if I trained on a lot of digs before I came to ANU, I'd be, you know, up there with everyone else. But it turned out I was quite an unusually seasoned field hand by the time I came to ANU. And I found enthusiasm opened a lot of doors as well. It's really hard to appreciate now how little we knew of the desert when my eyes turned to research in the region. An Adelaide boy always looked north to the Red Centre. So I was very fortunate that my first professional job was as a government field archaeologist in the Northern Territory, with the Northern Territory Museum. I was able to work across Central Australia. You also need to remember, of course, that this was a land rights era. It was a hothouse for community politics, where the heroes of the day were travel-weary anthropologists in dusty leather jackets, rimed with kangaroo blood and red sand, and with a savoir-faire that suggested access to secret knowledge. You know, I used to admire those guys. I was an outsider. I was an archaeologist. I was a dirt archaeologist. But I say lucky because, apart from the opportunity to work across Central Australia, I found, like many of my generation working in remote Australia, that the remote Australia avoided much of the collision between archaeologists and Aboriginal people that took place in southern Australia, where the growth and reinvention of identity and tradition, Aboriginal identity and tradition, made archaeology a battleground, shifting the equation from affirmation of a proud past to an apparent appropriation of that past by white fellas. I mean, I never saw it this way, but that's the sort of tone of the debate. Remote Australia escaped much of this. We worked on what was already Aboriginal land, largely within a functioning clan and totemic system, the remnants of a polity, no doubt, but still a political system we operated within. It all seemed rather straightforward, and we had a personal obligation to do the right thing, to follow the right protocols, personal, because we would personally be liable to the consequences. I mean, Dick Gould, who missed his step in this regard, very nearly became the first archaeologist to be speared. I didn't quite stumble in this way, but occasionally I did put a foot wrong. I remember working with the land council, with a big bush party of Aliara Aboriginal men and women, and being asked how old a certain panel of rock paintings were. And they were of yellow ochre, and that which is notoriously friable. They couldn't have been very old. I hazarded a guess that they were done by some men of their grandfather's generation. And I was working for them on a native title claim. And people got very angry in the camp all through the night. And the next morning I was brought to account and I was given a lecture. We don't change our law like white fellas change your clothes. This is the dreaming. They've always been here. I'd forgotten that I was being asked a trick question. Our archaeology was being asked to validate a religious system, not to analyse these paintings. It's a system I respect, but this is what we worked with. I've enjoyed the open desert where I can see the structure of the landscape, and I think we've seen the beauty of our deserts over today. But I've also enjoyed the opportunity to see the desert from a range of perspectives. You know, I've walked over large sections on archaeological surveys. I've driven across country with my four-wheel drive mates. I've travelled and talked the land with Aboriginal men, often with a senior man talking me through the mythology while I drove, explaining details that I didn't really appreciate the significance of at first. And like many archaeologists of my generation, I've gradually, almost imperceptibly, been drawn into the expansive and expanding world of the dreaming, seeing the land as a storied landscape, rich in mythology. So I love the sense that you can take all these different perspectives and you can hold the land up like a jewel to the light and turn it around and watch its different pattern and personality refracted in the light as you turn that gem around. That's the milieu. I've shared that with many archaeologists, and Peter Veth is here, Giles Hamm, and so forth. But let's ask the question, what would make a complete archaeologist? You know, we've played with that title. Originally it had a question mark, and my colleagues generously deleted that. Well, it's such a broad field that I think everyone would have a different take on this, and perhaps a complete archaeologist would have to be a composite of many individuals. I'd just like to say over the years I've had some marvellous mentors, co-researchers, departmental colleagues. The best of these were intellectually and personally generous, with a sense of the history of archaeology, the gravitas and drama of research. They wrote good, clean prose, perhaps even elegant prose, and they had a nose for the main chance of research. The best were good in the field. They were field archaeologists with a strong feel for the nuances of stratigraphy and stratigraphic excavation. They were polymaths, with an ability to turn ideas into research projects and an ability to make the most of the really rather austere archaeological evidence that Aboriginal archaeology presents. It's a very lean, austere record we have to work with. Turning it into a history is not easy. The best were also humanist scholars, not just good scientists, but also humanist scholars, reaching out to immerse themselves in the scholarship of another world, an Aboriginal world, to understand traditional Aboriginal society in its own terms and through its own eyes. In a sense, we have to be a cultural historian. So, I mean, we don't necessarily have to adapt that approach in our work, but we have to understand enough about these societies to respect them and operate within them. Now, all of these are qualities I've aspired to in my own work with various degrees of success. And, of course, I've just been grateful for the journey. You know, I see myself as a tradesman archaeologist. I didn't set out to be God's gift to archaeology, and I don't think I'm there. I've liked archaeology because it combines intellectual passion with the hard practical realities of fieldwork. I've thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to travel the desert with Aboriginal men and women, the long red dirt roads, the impromptu mechanical repairs, the hauling of drums of fuel, the forensic work of archaeological science, the craft of digging a site, struggling to dissect an often cryptic stratigraphy, and the rush of interdisciplinary work with historians and quaternarists. All of this I've enjoyed. All of this goes into the mix to make a complete archaeologist. But remote area work also brought its own special demands. We send young field archaeologists out into quite remote areas and just see if they survive. When I joined the Northern Territory Museum in 1980, I was given a Roneoed manual outlining bush repairs to a four-wheel drive. The museum's field officer, Carl Roth at that time, had put it together, and alarmingly he had lost a couple of fingers cut off when they were trapped in a collapsing wallaby jack. He had to cut his fingers off because he was in a remote area and couldn't get his hand out of the jack. I was also alarmed to see there was a section explaining how to replace a damaged rear wheel by lashing a piece of timber to the undercarriage of a vehicle as a skid. I wasn't quite sure I could do all of this, but it seemed to be expected. Unfortunately, I never had to do all this, but I did have one notorious trip into the Strzelecki Desert when other aspects of hazards of remote area work came into play. My then 10-year-old son went missing. He went to track his rabbit snares and missed his way back to camp. And we had to track him through the night for 8 kilometres, eventually finding him safe and sound. Any parent will appreciate the cold chill when you realise you have one chance to retrieve the situation, or the heat will kill him tomorrow. He's here today, or was, with no ill effect from his misadventure, fortunately. It's all such a long way from those comments of one British archaeologist writing about 1915 that an essential skill of a field archaeologist was the capacity to withstand the rigours of a British hotel at all seasons of the year. and I think another attribute of a complete archaeologist is an interest in communicating your discipline at various levels. You need to be a good communicator. I just love to read a well-researched, well-machined research paper. It's a pleasure to come across an engaging blog, a newspaper interview with a clear account of a research project and its context, or a museum exhibition with a bit of theatre, drama and impact. You know, as a museum curator, I've tried my hand at all of these, just as part and parcel of the job. But any attempt to stimulate public interest in archaeology is really to be encouraged. And I'm struck by when I started out and was interested in archaeology, there was almost nothing to read on Australian archaeology. John Mulvaney's 1969 book, The Prehistory of Australia. But now there's a whole shelf, you know. Josephine Flood's, Peter Hiscox, and so on and so forth. Bruno Davies' wonderful book. It just goes on and on. A really rich resource for an inquiring mind. And if you love your field, you also realise that the field is not a fixed edifice. Archaeology is a field created and recreated every day through our own actions and conduct as archaeologists. Archaeology is what we make it. So, it's important that we, do the best work we can, the most thorough research projects we can, that we build assets for the field, that we mentor or at least encourage colleagues and younger students, all of that sort of stuff. And I've tried my bit, even when I felt that people perhaps moving in on my territory a bit. It's all a tall order. Not everyone can be good at everything, but my generation of archaeologists on the whole, I think, have made a really good fist of it. So while I personally relish all the attention today, I like to think that today is also celebrates a generation of a fairly talented generation of Australian-trained archaeologists, and many of them are here today. So thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.